It's 5:30. I'm Nora Flaherty, and you are listening to MPBN Radio. Ahead on Main Things Considered this evening, concern among those who care for adults with intellectual disabilities about a new plan from the LePage administration. And police apologize for taking more than 2 hours to respond to a 911 call from a York County daycare. First, this news from NPR. It's 5:32. I'm Nora Flaherty with this look at Maine news. Members of the legislature's Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee heard over 4 hours of testimony today on two bills aimed at fixing a one-word mistake in the omnibus energy bill passed last year. The error led to a $40 million reduction in funding for energy efficiency programs. Republican Senator Roger Cates from Augusta co-sponsored the bill that simply restores the word "and" left out of the law's final version. Scores of businesses and advocacy groups testified in support of that bill, but Governor Paul LePage is backing a measure that ties the funding fix to a proposal to create an energy commissioner and gives the governor the power to nominate the head of Efficiency Maine. Energy Office Director Patrick Woodcock says the governor wants legislative approval for fees imposed to fund the program, something now the purview of the Public Utilities Commission.
The governor strongly believes that any fee and tax should be considered fully by the legislature, an elected body, not a commission. It's a principle that he applies to government.
Katz says that for him, the issue simply involves fixing a clerical error, honoring one's word, and doing the right thing without delay. Saying that Bath Iron Works is violating its contract with workers by trying to change job descriptions outside of formal contract negotiations, BIW's largest union filed a lawsuit in federal court today to prevent the dispute from going to arbitration. The Portland Press-Herald is reporting that Local S6 President Jay Wadley says the union agrees the company needs to cut costs, but that management forced a conflict by filing for arbitration outside of usual contract talks. The paper says BIW wants the cost reductions to improve its chance of landing a contract to build U.S. Coast Guard cutters. The company sent a message to its workforce today that says the collective bargaining agreement between BIW and Local S6 directly addresses adjusting certain job tasks. BIW says the agreement allows the company to reassign or reallocate employee job functions after providing the union with notice and engaging in discussions, and that when the union refused to participate in discussions, the company proceeded to arbitration. And sales of single-family homes in Maine were up more than 6% in March over the year before. The median price was up almost 5% to $170,000. In weather tonight, cloudy with occasional light showers and areas of fog. Lows tonight in the mid-30s to low 40s, north to south. This is MPBN Radio. This is Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty. The LePage administration says it wants to streamline the process of setting reimbursement rates for services to adults with intellectual disabilities by not requiring a public hearing. More than a dozen families and support organizations opposed the bill today at the State House. They say the lack of public input could have serious safety ramifications. A.J. Higgins has more.
Anna McDougall of Wiscasset was among those who traveled to testify before the legislature's Health and Human Services Committee. She urged the members to carefully scrutinize the LePage bill, which would affect people with intellectual disabilities like her, and also people with autism who are covered by MaineCare. McDougall says the proposal would eliminate the need for a public hearing and effectively silence the people who depend on those services.
People with disabilities, we have feelings. We are people and individuals. Like myself.
Opponents, including the families of affected Mainers, say they're concerned that the proposed changes could have a detrimental impact on the quality of services to individuals with significant needs.
It's my belief that the legislature not only provides a voice for the people who elect them to office, but also serves as an important part of our governmental system of checks and balances.
David Cowing of Woolwich is the father of an adult son who has an intellectual disability and mental health issues. He says he relies on the public hearing process to ensure that his son receives the level of benefits he needs. He worries about what could happen if that process becomes less transparent and removed from legislative oversight.
I'm very concerned that this proposed rule change could result in reduction in the quality of services currently being delivered to individuals who already receive supports, while leaving many others needing support services remaining on wait lists for an indeterminate length of time without formal legislative review.
Last year, the state reached a legal settlement with hundreds of adults with autism and other developmental disabilities who had been on a waiting list for services. Some opponents to the proposed change are suspicious that it's related to the waiting list issue. Ray Nagel, Executive Director of the Independence Association in Brunswick, says he also believes that the state's intentions to utilize a SIS, or Supports Intensity Scale, to determine benefit rates, and the proposed switch eliminating legislative review are both designed to save money to put toward the waiting list.
I think that there is a correlation, possibly, between the new SIS allocation method and the waiting list. It's actually on the DHHS website that a lot of the savings that they would derive from the SIS that they would apply to the waiting list.
But Samuel Seneff, Director of Maine Care Policy for DHHS, says the change to the rulemaking process was intended to streamline the procedure. He points out that the current rulemaking for rate setting for services to people with intellectual disabilities and autism are governed by different sections of law.
Processing these rules separately is an administrative and financial burden on the department. Relief from separate rulemakings will be administratively efficient and reduce noticing and printing costs. Providers would have a better opportunity to offer comments that will affect the rule.
And Seneff said the new process would not silence providers or family members, as opponents have suggested.
The public would still have ample input during the regular rulemaking process and before the rule was put into effect.
Lawmakers on the committee will weigh the proposed changes further at a future work session. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
You're listening to Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. Still to come, neighbors sharing solar energy. But first, the head of the Maine State Police has personally apologized for his agency's delayed response to a 911 call last week reporting an intruder at a York County daycare center. Colonel Robert Williams also says an investigation is being launched to find out why it took more than 2 hours to respond and to ensure it doesn't happen again. Tom Porter has more.
Colonel Robert Williams summoned reporters to the Maine State Police barracks in Alfred Wednesday morning to make one thing clear.
Pretty simple. We failed.
The Maine State Police, he says, failed to uphold its obligation to the public.
We could run from it. We could hide from it. It's pretty clear. We were 2.5 hours or a little over 2 hours responding to it. It happened. And it's not a proud moment for us, but we're here today to apologize for that and ensure people it won't happen again.
Shortly after noon last Friday, two female workers at Little Hands Big Hearts Daycare Center in Dayton, which is about 10 miles from the Alfred Police Barracks, heard noises from the second floor, which was supposed to be empty. Six children were there at the time. The staff member's first action was to call her boss, daycare owner Julianne Dolbeck, who was in Vermont at the time. Dolbeck takes up the story.
I think her biggest concern when she first heard of the situation was, hey, Julie, were you expecting company? And I'm like, no, I'm 4 hours away. And then she said, well, all the kitchen cupboards are open, the closets are open, I heard the door slam.
Then, according to reports, she saw a man running away from the house. When she heard this, Dolbeck says she texted a sheriff's deputy, who's a personal friend. He then advised her to call 911. That was just before 12:30 p.m. Dayton is a community where 911 calls are answered by the state police. But it was close to 3 p.m. before a trooper turned up. Colonel Williams says the officer originally called upon could not go because he was tied up in a car chase that became a drug bust. But he says there were other resources at their disposal.
There were resources that they weren't readily available that we could have called out. We have a call sharing agreement or a resource coordination agreement with the sheriff's department. We regularly back each other up. They would have responded if we called. This is a case that we just didn't use the resources at our disposal timely. That's all there is to it.
Dolbeck says she accepts the apology.
I think they know that they messed up and they're going to take care of it.
Colonel Williams says no disciplinary action has been taken yet, but the agency is far from done with the matter. Over the next couple of weeks, he says three members of the state police will conduct what's known as an after-action review to try and find out what went wrong.
We're going to gather all the facts and analyze them. My first interest is putting a plan together so this doesn't happen again. Whether we discipline anybody isn't going to change the outcome of what happened, and it's not going to change what happens in the future. Other than that individual, we want to make sure as an agency we're responding in a timely fashion.
Meanwhile, last Friday's alleged break-in at the daycare, in which nothing was taken and nobody was hurt, also remains under investigation by the state police. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
Finally today, the sun unexpectedly and welcome popped out in parts of Maine today on what was forecast to be kind of a gray and gloomy day. On this Earth Day, it was especially welcomed by a small but growing number of people who are making a philosophical and financial commitment to solar power. Their own rooftops might not be appropriate for harnessing the sun rays, but their friends and neighbors' rooftops are. And so they're investing in what's known as community solar. Tonight in our ongoing series, Beyond 350, Confronting Climate Change, Susan Sharon explains why they're doing it and how it works.
Russ and Judy Florence say they like to do their part for the environment. They want to keep their carbon footprints on the planet small. Now in their 60s, they grow much of their own food in a vegetable garden on their farm in South Paris. They also raise broiler chickens and beef. And when it comes to energy, they try to conserve.
We live in a fairly small house, and we, we're as well insulated as we can be, and we don't use a lot of electricity. We don't have TVs in every bedroom, you know.
We do our little bit and contribute as we can.
One of those contributions is to host the first community solar project in Maine. It was completed last fall.
I think this barn doesn't have quite as good an angle as the barns up there did, but still pretty close to ideal.
Just below the Florence's house is an old metal chicken barn in a large field. It's about 300 feet long, and on the south side of the roof are 150 solar panels. The project is co-owned by 8 other people who live in different parts of southern Maine and who, for whatever reason, can't put solar panels on their own homes. Currently in Maine, there's a limit of 10 people who can share in a solar project, although there is a proposal to raise that number to 50 or more. The members' shares were each calculated according to their regular electricity consumption. Russ and Judy own an 8% share that cost them about $8,000.
Like any solar project, your primary recovery of your investment is through energy savings.
Fortunate Mueller is co-founder of Revision Energy in Portland, which developed the project.
So, you buy a share in this solar array, and over time, your electric bill goes down because you're generating some fraction or all of your electricity from a solar farm up on the hill.
Russ and Judy expect to be free of electric bills in about 12 years. In the meantime, they do need to pay Central Maine Power for a delivery charge and a line fee.
And we are sympathetic to their situation because we appreciate having electricity on cloudy days, and we know that infrastructure has to be there.
Essentially, they're sharing the sun on the grid for a credit. The result is they've had to get more diligent about reading their CMP bills and figuring out how much electricity they've consumed.
We get credit on our bill, and if we use the whole amount that month, then we pay less to CMP. If we don't use it, then we can bank it for the months when it's not as sunny. But it's like a rolling thing. You can keep it on for a year, and if you don't use it in that year's time, then it just gets eaten up by the grid. It's gone.
Our company supports renewables. Our parent company is one of the biggest renewable developers in the world.
But CMP spokeswoman Gail Rice points out that community solar projects are subsidized by other customers, and she says that's a concern.
Our estimates indicate that people who do not own solar generation will be subsidizing solar customers to the tune of about $55 million per year by the year 2022, and that's a huge hardship on a lot of our customers who are poor and who already have trouble paying their bills.
Supporters of solar power say in the face of climate change, there will need to be a paradigm shift in energy production, where it comes from and how it's generated. And the markets, they say, will respond accordingly. For now, residential and commercial solar is growing by leaps and bounds around the country. Interest in community solar projects is also on the rise, including here in Maine.
We're just getting ready to close on all the paperwork on the project.
David Nutt is one of the 9 owner members of a planned community solar installation on an old dairy farm in Edgecombe. He says his investment was expensive, more than $10,000, but he expects to save 80% of his electric bill in the first year.
The other side of the equation is the production of solar energy versus fossil fuel energy, and we feel it's really important to do this.
Another community solar project is tentatively planned for Bar Harbor, where members of the town council envision leasing out roof space at a public works site. The plan is subject to local residents' approval. Fortunate Mueller of Revision Energy says what's clear is that Maine has the ability to produce a significant amount of solar power. The challenge is finding the political will to make it happen. For MPBN News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And our series Beyond 350 is made possible by the Dorie Taylor Charitable Foundation. It's 12 minutes before 6 o'clock. Time to check the weather forecast tonight with meteorologist Paul Janis.
Upper-level energy continues to spin in from the Great Lakes, and we'll see a rinse, lather, and repeat forecast for the next several forecast periods across the state of Maine. Cloudy tonight with occasional light showers. Areas of fog will develop. Lows 35 to 40 north to south. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy, breaks of sun over southern Maine, scattered showers late day, highs 42 to 52. Mostly cloudy Friday, scattered showers, highs mid-40s to mid-50s. Mostly cloudy Saturday statewide, isolated showers, highs 45 to 55. Increasing sunshine on Sunday, isolated showers over eastern sections of Maine, highs 45 to 55. For the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm meteorologist Paul Janis.
And that's Maine Things Considered. Thanks today to Mal Leary, Ed Morin, and Barbara Caritti. I'm Nora Flaherty.